Excuse me.
Sie hören die Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called wavelength.
Good afternoon, I'm William English and you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, which goes out at 3pm on Fridays and is now repeated at the new time of 7:30 on Tuesday evenings. Last week I interviewed Clive Graham about the release on his Paradigm label of Machine by Trevor Wishart, and we played extracts from that CD, originally released in 1973. Machine will be played in its entirety of just over 50 minutes on next Wednesday's Clear Spot. That is February the 20th between 8 and 9 p.m. You will need a pen or pencil and a diary for the next announcement. Several weeks ago, we featured a newly formed percussion outfit called Benghazi, which included myself as Umtebe Noginga, Gwenda Jones and James Tregaskis, who vomited profusely, intentionally I should add. The group disbanded immediately due to internal conflicts, but then reformed without Gwenda Jones. Next week, James and myself will engage in crying and misery. So that's Benghazi next Friday the 22nd at 3pm. I'll just wait whilst you make a note in your diaries. Next week sees the opening at Tate Modern of an exhibition of Marcel Duchamp, Francis Picabia and Man Ray. And 2 weeks ago, I played Picabia's only musical composition, The American Nurse, 1920, which consists of three notes on a piano played for infinity. I'm starting this week with an interview between Duchamp and George Heard Hamilton, recorded in London in 1959, in which Duchamp talks about his ready-mades. Later in the programme, I'll be playing several tracks from a new release of A Flat Man, Ivor Cutler's final album, originally released in 1998, but unavailable for several years. The release marks the anniversary of Ivor Cutler's death 2 years ago, and also the launch of Horgie House Records, a new company set up by Ivor's family. But first, Marcel Duchamp from 1959.
The first one was in 1913. It was a bicycle wheel.
Just an ordinary wheel?
An ordinary wheel, a bicycle wheel, on a stand. I would turn it as I passed by. The movement of it would be like a fire in a fireplace. You know, it has that attraction of something moving in the room while you think about something else. Then the second one was a bottle dryer. You know, they have in cellars, in the French cellars, you put the bottles up.
The wine bottles.
The wine bottles. When they're empty, you put them on. And
after they've been washed.
Yes. And then the third one was a snow shovel, which I did here in New York when I first came in 1915. It was just a plain snow shovel, bought it in a hardware shop. Uh-huh. And it's now, one replica of it is in Yale. Another one was called Why Not Sneeze? Of course, the title is not a descriptive title because that ready-made was made of a birdcage, a small birdcage, in which instead of a bird, there were cubes which looked like sugar cubes.
The cubes were white marble.
That was the pun, the visual pun that you, when you picked it up, you understood it was marble and no more on sugar.
Yes.
I also added a thermometer in it. Another one was the vial. I was in Paris in 1919, and I was thinking of bringing back a present for Arnsberg in California. So I went to a drugstore and said, will you give me a vial that you'll empty of whatever serum is in it and seal it again, and what it'll be in it will be Paris, air of Paris. Of course, it had to be. So the druggist did it, and I brought my present to Arnsberg, to California. It was called a vial with 50 cubic centimeters of air of Paris.
Was that the last of the actual ready-mades to be manufactured?
Yes, but in my notes in the green box, I mentioned some that could be made. One is, I call it a reciprocal ready-made. You take a painting by Rembrandt, and instead of looking at it, you use it plainly as an ironing board. You iron your clothes on it, so it becomes a ready-made and reciprocal.
If you're rather hard on the Rembrandt.
It is, but we had to be iconoclastic then.
Mr. Duchamp, there then are two kinds of ready-mades, those which exist, so to speak, already before you came upon them,
mm-hmm.
and those which you have assisted. Do you put any priority on one kind rather than the other?
No, it was sort of to add a little diversity to the idea. It was not a very active part of my life, except when you make one or two ready-mades a year, you have plenty of time for something else.
Mm-hmm. Do you think anybody else could make one?
Yes, everybody can, but as I don't attach any value, I mean commercial value or even artistic value to it, hardly anybody would do it for the sake of doing it.
Is there any way in which we can think of a ready-made as a work of art?
That is the very difficult point, because art first has to be defined. All right. Can we try to define art? We have tried. Everybody has tried. And every century there's a new definition of art, meaning that there's no essential, and one essential that is good for all centuries. So if we accept the idea of trying not to define art, which is a very legitimate conception, then the ready-made comes in as a sort of irony. Because it says, here it is, a thing that I call art. I didn't even make it myself. As we know, art, etymologically speaking, means to make, hand make. And there, instead of making it, I take it ready-made. So it was a form of denying the possibility of defining art. And because you don't define electricity, you just see the results of electricity, but you don't define it.
But with the ready-mades, it seems to me that they carry out of the world of everyday life, out of the hardware shop,
mm-hmm.
as in the case of the snow shovel, something of your own sense of irony and wit. And therefore, can't we believe that they have some sort of
message?
Not message, no, but value, which is artistic, even though you haven't made them, yet your intention in setting them aside from everything else
yes.
in the world, does not that give them some kind of possibly intellectual value?
It has a conceptual value, if you want to say conceptual. I don't know whether it means exactly what we want to say. It has, but it takes away all the technical jargon of painting. Painting should be made with colors. Painting should be made with a pencil, with brushes. And when you take something that is not made by those technical instruments, then you don't know where you are. You don't know whether you should take it as a work of art. And that's where the irony comes in.
The irony, of course, is very much part of the Dada spirit, isn't it?
Yes. That was a very important form of introducing humor in a very serious world at the time, First World War.
You said once to me some years ago that the Dada spirit had been operating, so to speak, in New York with you, for instance, and Man Ray, before Dada was named as a movement in 1916.
Oh, yes, it was in the air, as many of these things are. And we certainly had the same spirit as in Zurich when Zara and Arp and Ilsenbeck started under the name of Dada. They found the name. Of course, the name was a good sort of flag around which all these ideas expressed.
A slogan.
Yes, a slogan. And that helped the movement a lot. And of course, the Dada spirit has always existed, exists today. A man like Rabelais, he certainly is a Dada in essence. So is Jarry, a great man, and we could find any number of them in the past centuries.
Would you consider that Dada is more than just a criticism of art? Is it also a criticism of society?
It is, completely much more. It's been the nonconformist spirit which has existed in every century, every period since man is man.
Another work, which is the large glass, the Bride stripped bare by her own bachelors in the English translation?
Yes.
Which is now in the Philadelphia Museum.
It was started in 1912, 13, 14. I worked on it before the war. And even though I tried in that big glass to find a completely personal and new expression, the final product was to be a wedding of mental and visual reactions. In other words, the ideas in the glass are more important than the actual visual realization.
But this sounds almost contradictory, because a work of art is primarily a visual experience.
Yes, but this welding of two different sources of inspiration gave me a satisfactory answer to in my research for something that had not been previously attempted. Being the young man who wants to do something by himself and not copy the others, not use too much of the tradition, my research was in that direction, to find some way of expressing myself without being a painter, without being a writer, without taking one of these labels, and yet producing something that would be an inner product of myself. The two things, mixing up the ideas and their visual representation, attracted me as a technique, if it has to be a technique after all. And this hybrid form explains why I didn't have anyone to agree with me more or less, or to follow my ways of looking at it.
You had to invent everything for the first time.
Yes, because since Courbet, as you know, the revolution of Courbet was mainly a visual revolution, what you call a retinian revolution. He insisted without even mentioning it, on that a painting is to be looked at and only looked at, and the reaction should be visual or retinal, plain physical reaction in front of a painting. And this has been going on since Courbet. It's still in vogue, if I may say, today. If you speak to a painter today, he will never think of an anecdote of it. It's all the line, the form, the play of the colors together, and the more abstract, the better.
And all of that has nothing to do with the glass.
I thought it was a reaction against the retinal conception of painting, and I think it does, it still has. Because of the introduction of the conceptual, not entirely literary, because you might call it, well, this is literary painting, it's been done before, of course, but it's much deeper than literary. It's using words, but then everything that uses words is not necessarily literary, as you know.
No. Are there any ready-made elements in the glass?
Hardly, no. No, there's hardly any ready-made. It was two different departments in my activities at the time.
That was an interview with Marcel Duchamp from 1959, talking to George Hurd Hamilton in London, and that's from a CD called Voices of Dada. And there's a big exhibition opening at Tate Modern. I think it opens on the 21st of February, of Marcel Duchamp, Francis Picabia, and Man Ray. So the next half of the programme will be comprised of tracks from a new CD by Ivor Cutler, who died 2 years ago. This is originally released in 1998, but unavailable for several years. So there's about 48 tracks on this CD, many of them very short, some of them only about 20 seconds. So I'll be playing a sort of an edited selection from it.
Living Donkey. A man walked down our street with a living donkey hanging from his neck by a chain. Every so often the donkey would say, "Hee-haw," you know, and the man would bend his knees enough to let the donkey's hind leg rest on the pavement for about 25 seconds. He told me 25 seconds was the optimum for a donkey. And so do I. There is a horse, she stands in my neighbor's field. The meadow slopes, and so does the horse. She cannot rest, I hear her through the night crying, "Let me lie down in your garden, Ivor, I'm in agony." I'd love to help, the garden's full of grass. It's flat as a pancake, and so is the grass. But I'm so comfy, I cannot bear to get up. So I cry, "Why don't you ask me during the day when I'm not in bed?" But you know horses, and so do I. Do mi fa so so, and so do I.
Questionnaire. What do you think about the chicken with its big feathery skin? I don't know nothing about the chicken, I'm a mole. Give me a sledge and a hill of dirt going deep into the earth, and I'm as happy as a sand boy with an adult mature worm waiting at the end of the run. I've just seen my first chicken with its big feathery skin. Would you mind repeating your question? I'm a mole. Just make it snappy, I want to get back in my sledge. There's a lot of chickens running about the underground passages. What do you think about the chicken with its big feathery skin?
Fabulous. I think they're fabulous.
Aquarium. Smooth fish, break your quest. Nuzzle my belly, soft with food. Your barbels sprawl about my lips. My eye hangs loose by a thick nerve.
a slow suck for a flounder with a big mouth. My lungs fill with red spawn. As I disappear, bit by bit, my green bones fur in lonely peace. The bowling green. The green is so flat, it is an inland square sea, a great green cube to swim in. Hidden fish swim infinitesimally slowly, 100 years an inch. The greenkeeper, an Irish Poseidon, tends the surface plankton. Once jaunty, now a flabby bubble. Do not pity him. He lives at a different speed and listens for his fish. A romantic man. I never saw a woman, but I followed her down the street and lay down at her feet. I never saw a woman. She used to get very embarrassed and tried to walk away, and tried to walk away. But I grab hold of her ankles. Oh, stop your bloody nonsense. Do you think your Harpo Marx? Do you think your Harpo Marx? I never saw a woman. Then I'd stand right up and kiss her lips until they'd gone all dry. I'll keep on kissing women until the day they die. For women are like flowers, and I'm a romantic man, and I'm a romantic man. And I like to watch their fingers as they close round the throat of a man. I never saw a woman. A woman, a woman, a woman. Garbles, 1930. The message boy had green snot running down his nose. Granny Goldberg gave him a big green cooker. Snot flowed over the sharply defined upper lip onto the sharp bitten apple. Brown teeth on white tart flesh. Uncle Joe shared a lavvy with 7 families on a steep circular staircase. I went in with the steel key. The bowl was all diarrhoea and choked newspaper. It was stranger's diarrhoea. I decided to wait.
These tracks are all from a new CD. It's by Ivor Cutler, called A Flat Man, and that's due for release on the 17th of March. And so we'll play out with what is actually the longest track on the CD, which lasts 4 minutes. And the title of this is Doing the Bathroom. This show is repeated at 7:30 on Tuesdays.
Episode 1,
doing the bathroom. "This mince needs something," grunted Father, returning a barely chewed mouthful to his dessert spoon. He looked at it thoughtfully, prodded it gently, and banged it onto his plate. Then he lifted me by the collar. "Away downstairs and find something, quick. The mince isn't going to get hotter." As I ran out the front door, pausing to pick myself up after my big sister's leg had shot out like lightning to add a spice of danger to my mission, I could hear Mother scraping the mince back into the pot to keep it warm. I reached the middens in no time and jumped straight into the first one. A cloud of cinders rose and I could no longer see, but I could hear the clink of glass below my feet. Crouching down, I felt for bottles, then rubbed them on my jersey to see what they were. 3 beer bottles, a milk bottle, a bottle of castor oil, half used, and a bottle of OK sauce. I grabbed the OK and jumped out, placed it on the grass, and leapt straight into the middle one. It was all kipper bones, skins, and potato peelings. "It's got to be number 3, I thought, panic rising in my chest. My prayer was answered. Number 3 was full. I could pick and choose. I stuffed 6 sauce bottles and 3 wine bottles up my jersey, kicked the OK sauce contemptuously to one side, made my way back like a bottle nearly come to term, and banged my head on the door. When it opened, I staggered over to the sink, where Mother deftly transferred my treasure below the tap. My big sister wiped them dry on Mother's pinny and placed them in gorgeous array on the kitchen table. Father emptied the wine, 2 whites and a red, into our Queen's Arms 1-pint glass mug. Mother slapped sauce into the mince with the heel of her sturdy hand. It took 4 bottles to get the taste right. Then we sat down to a banquet of riotously flavoured mince and wee sips of wine, followed by 3 pineapple chunks each with juice. Afterwards, as we children lay, replete on the carpet, burping quietly, Mother's eye caught my jersey. "Look at you," she screamed, and raising me across her knee, beat me like an old rug, and raising, as far as I could see, a good-sized cloud of dust.
Thank you.